to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Hey folks, thanks for joining us. My name is Larry Jacobs. I am the director for the Center of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. We're going to be beginning in a moment, but I did want to let you know that you'll see at the bottom of your screen, there's a Q&A button, and that is your very important opportunity to participate in today's conversation by submitting a written question. We rely on those, as you'll see. So please join and give us some good questions. You also see at the bottom, there's a live transcript feature. And if you'd like that, please click on that and we can provide that. Our guests for today's program, the threats to the 2024 elections, are two superstars in the area of elections. Jennifer Morrell was an election administrator for a number of years, and now she's a partner at the Elections Group, which is a premier firm providing technical assistance to state and local election officials around the country. They provide feedback on all aspects of election administration, and it means that Jennifer Morrell is one of the people who knows what's going on around the country, in the states, and at the local level, a tremendous expert to have with us today. Jennifer Morrell is also an adjunct faculty member here at the University of Minnesota, Humphrey School. She is one of our prize popular instructors in their certificate in election administration. It's a great program. It's a way to get involved in helping to run elections. If you're interested, let us know, or simply go on Google and you can find it. We're also joined by Rick Hassan, who's the Gary T. Schwartz Endowed Chair in Law and Professor of Political Science and Director of the Safeguarding Democracy Project at UCLA School of Law. He has published widely as a scholar, and he's also published widely in a variety of newspapers and popular outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and more. He's also widely quoted in the Election Law Blog, which is another go-to source. So two terrific people. We're grateful that you're both with us. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Great to be here.
There are a lot of concerns about the upcoming election and the threats to it. And the concerns are both about what's going to happen between now and Election Day, and then maybe less focused, but concerns about what might happen between the Election Day when the ballots are cast and the certification in Congress January 6th. So we're going to try to add a little bit of clarity as we walk through and talk about the threats to elections. Rick Hassan, what do you see as the threats during the election period? We're going to have these intense few months. It's a toss-up election. What should people be focused on?
Well, first, let me say it's great to be with you, and I appreciate all the work that you and your program do to help educate election administrators and the public about the importance of the mechanics behind our democracy. So thank you for all of that. Let me say that there are many threats to elections. There are in every election, but it's important to have a kind of a balanced and not a panicky approach to all of this. This is probably the third presidential election season where we've worried about the potential for foreign interference, hacking into voter registration databases, disinformation. Those kinds of things, those are real threats. For the most part, Those are threats that are being countered by American security, cybersecurity forces. There are other kinds of threats too that are much less sexy, but probably just as important, like the threat of inadequate resources being given to election administrators. That's probably a bigger threat because, you know, an election is probably the most complex thing we as a country do besides, as a country, besides going to war. It involves a lot of people. We have a decentralized system. In a very close election, the attention turns to the weakest link, the places where the problems crop up. So you really have to make sure that, you know, the bottom is very strong because of the problems we had in terms of people's confidence in the 2020 election, which I'm sure we'll get into. There is a concern about attrition of election officials. Election officials have faced harassment and threats. We're worried about political violence. Already we've seen an attempted assassination of one of our presidential candidates. There's other kinds of violent threats coming from both inside and outside the United States. But I think we're actually in much better shape than we were in 2020. Just to remind everyone of the unpleasant times, in the 2020 election, we had to deal with a pandemic. We had to deal with great shifts in how elections were being conducted, much more voting by mail, social distancing, additional costs. It was really uncertain of the problems with the postal system. We have those today too, but things were much more dire then. And the fact that we're not in the midst of that kind of panicked societal upheaval is going to make things, I think, go more smoothly this time. I'll stop there. There's obviously more to say, but we're coming in. Some of it is new, some of it is old, but I feel like the system is pretty resilient and everybody is on alert to look out for the things, at least that we've seen in the past in terms of threats.
Thank you very much, Rick Hassan. Jennifer Morrell, you work with state and local election officials. What are you seeing around the country in terms of threats?
Sure. So first, Larry, I just want to say what an honor it is for me to be able to work with those state and local election officials. They're an amazing group. This will be my 15th year working in elections. And I can say without hesitation, I'm sort of echoing what Rick said, this is going to be the best run election we've ever had administratively. Certainly, the things that were mentioned, turnover, attrition, struggles with adequate resources in terms of people and facilities and money are real. And yet this is a resilient lot that continues to push the envelope in terms of better accounting, better audits, better security, both cybersecurity, physical security, continue to work to ensure voter rolls are accurate, that list maintenance is happening regularly. So from an administrative perspective, I think we're in a better place than we've ever been. We have more jurisdictions, more states with new voting equipment, with auditable paper records and performing post-election audits. We continue to see new and innovative things happening in terms of pre-election testing. So there's some good news, but the threats continue to be the same threats that the same group of folks have had to endure for the last 4 years, which is this constant criticism, being under a spotlight, and not just from their voters, but criticism and a need to respond even to the very commissioners or members of their community that are supposed to be supporting them. We continue to see unprecedented numbers of FOIA requests. You know, that's kind of old news, but it hasn't gone away. These offices, when they should be focusing on the next 60 days of executing, are still dealing with FOIA requests. They're still dealing with people showing up, calling, emailing, demanding answers to false claims about the way that elections are being ran, responding, having to respond to lies and other misinformation. So from the perspective of the effects of mis and disinfo have had on our community, that's still a real threat. And I think as we move through the next few months, that's going to continue to be a threat. What we've all learned is, despite the good news, despite the things that are happening, despite the volumes of information that have been put out to try to help communicate the public and voters about the mechanics of how elections work, about the tests and checks that are being done, we find that often it either falls on deaf ears or is challenged in a way that we're still trying to figure out how to deal with. So
Jennifer, thank you so much. First, you know, FOIA, for folks who don't know, it's a legal process by which citizens and groups can request public documents. And there's a federal process, and then there's processes within the states. This is entirely legal, but it can become overwhelming when you've got requests for hundreds of thousands of pages from an office with very limited staffing. So that's what Jennifer is referring to. Jennifer, I want to just focus on something that I know a lot of people have concern about, and that you're dealing with frontline officials, which are the threats to them. And you and I both know people who have FBI officials on speed dial. We also know that there's been some number of people who have left election administration since January 2020. And, you know, the numbers vary in their variety of reasons, but it's possible that maybe a quarter of the election staff in 2020 have left, again, for a variety of reasons. But when you're talking with election officials, how serious are those threats? Is it kind of the kind of thing where the FBI really does need to be involved because they're so specific and ominous?
It's incredibly serious. And I think one of the things we don't talk about enough is these are threats and harassment to your local election administrators. It's happening to individuals that serve as poll workers. They are being targeted at the organizations like mine and others that are trying to support election officials. They're being targeted at all of the technology providers that provide the equipment and services that many of these offices need. So it is a community-wide assault. In many cases, what has become the norm are things like, you're going to be tried for treason, you're going to go to jail, we hope you hang. Certainly, we know that some individuals have faced more specific threats threatening their life and their family. And it's hard, I think, to really comprehend the impact that that's had on the community. It's present in every meeting, conference, conversation that I have, in both concern for the self, but also concern for one another. Many election officials concerned about how do they keep their staff safe, their poll workers safe, their voters safe. How do they keep their families safe? Again, I think we've seen them respond remarkably in terms of expanded engagement with local law enforcement to talk about how we can collaborate in building plans to support those offices. But we've also seen them have to make decisions when it comes to those scarce resources in terms of using those to install things like bulletproof glass or additional on-site security guards, more cameras, things like that, panic buttons. So it's real, it's present. Should the FBI be involved? You know, it's really tough. We all appreciate the importance of freedom of speech. And what we've learned over the last 4 years is there's a fine line between what becomes a true prosecutable threat, and Rick can probably speak to this more than myself, and what is just a constant barrage of harassment, however hateful and fear-inducing that is, often doesn't cross the line to where the FBI can really be involved.
Thank you. And folks, just a little bit of background here. Jennifer Morrell was a officer, enlisted person in the Air Force for a number of years. And so this is someone who takes security very seriously and in a variety of ways, in addition to her work for a number of years now in election administration. Rick Hassett, I want to switch over to you. There's been some big changes. Congress passed the Electoral Count Act in 2022. Supreme Court issued a pretty significant decision and more. Could you just explain what that is? Because that is part of this new environment we're in, and what you think the significance of those two changes and others.
Sure. So now I think we're getting into the period after voters vote and before Congress meets on January 6th, 2025 to confirm the winner. And I should say, before I turn to that period, there was just a story yesterday that the Department of Homeland Security is declaring this kind of a major event that's going to get extra security, which is entirely appropriate given what we saw on January 6th, 2021. So I think for many people understand that we have an electoral college and that our votes are not done by popular vote, that states are assigned a number of points essentially based on their populations, and that whoever gets a majority of electoral college votes in Congress is the winner. What I think people don't or didn't really understand is that there are a tremendous number of steps that take place between the time that a voter casts a ballot and the time that Congress actually votes, right? So what has to happen, there has to be a whole process of tabulating the votes and then of certifying those votes. All right, this is happening essentially on the county level. So we don't run a single election for president. We don't run 51 elections for president. We run more than 8,000 simultaneous elections for president, mostly on the county level. Votes have to be tabulated, and then they have to be certified as correct. And then after that, there's the potential for lawsuits that could contest the results in a very close election. There's also the potential for the votes to be recounted. This is aside from the recounts that Jennifer mentioned in relation to just making sure that the counts are accurate. But in a very close election, a losing candidate might seek to recount the votes. So that's the whole process. Eventually, the states, for the presidential election, the state's electoral college winner is declared. The electors, the people who are pledged to vote for this candidate, their names are sent to the Congress, and then these names are read, and then you essentially get the counting of the votes. And what we saw in the 2020 election aftermath last time was an attempt to try to subvert the will of the voters in a number of states where Biden won, but where there were Republican legislatures. And Trump and his allies were trying to get those legislatures to submit alternative slates of electors, saying that there were irregularities or fraud or some malfeasance that justified overturning the will of the people. And, you know, the theories on which the state legislatures can do this were both factually weak and legally weak. Factually weak because there were not significant irregularities in how the elections were run. There was not evidence of major fraud in any state. And legally, the claim that the state legislature had this kind of free-floating authority to do whatever it wanted, this is sometimes referred to as the independent state legislature theory. It's based in a couple of parts in the Constitution that give state legislatures the power to set the manner for conducting presidential elections and the rules for congressional elections. So two things of significance happened on the legal side. You mentioned them both briefly, but let me explain them. The first is that in December of 2022, Congress passed something called the Electoral Count Reform Act. It amended a law that went back to the 1870s called the Electoral Count Act. That's essentially a set of rules for how Congress is supposed to understand the Electoral College votes that come in from the states and what happens if there's a dispute. The rules were clarified to say, for example, that the vice president doesn't have the power on her own to just throw out Electoral College votes that she thinks are unfair, which is one of the theories that Trump advanced, that Mike Pence could have thrown out votes or held votes or sent them back to the states or something like that. There are also clarifications about state legislatures not having the ability to easily step in and substitute their will for the will of the legislature. So the statute that governs this has been changed. And so, you know, there's always the danger of fighting the last war again, but it's going to be harder to fight that last war again because of these changes in the rules. The other thing that happened, as you mentioned, was that the Supreme Court in 2023 decided a case called Moore versus Harper, which is a case involving this so-called independent state legislature theory. And the idea was that the case actually involved a partisan gerrymandering claim in North Carolina, but the legal principle that the Supreme Court adopted was to reject the idea that states that state legislatures have free-floating power to just do whatever they want, unconstrained by state law, unconstrained by state constitutions, unconstrained by state courts, unconstrained by governors. That legislatures are understood to act within the process of their state constitutions in terms of what power they have. So that path also has been closed down. However, the Supreme Court did say that state courts are limited in their interpretation of state laws related to federal elections and state constitutions, and that state courts, and I think this applies to election administrators in states too, state courts cannot arrogate the power of state legislatures. I think by, for example, totally mangling the reading of a statute so that it doesn't really comply with what the legislature intended. We don't know exactly what that means. That still leaves an opening for litigation. We've got a case right now in Pennsylvania's Supreme Court that could end up at the Supreme Court and give us more clarity on this question. It's not an easy path to subverting the election results the way that the more extreme version that the court rejected and more is gone, but it does add some uncertainty to the post-election process if there is a very close election.
Wonderful, folks. Hey, that was a mini lecture on current law, and thank you for that. Let's zero in on some of the changes that have occurred at the states, and this has gotten quite a bit of attention as well. The history has been that there are nonpartisan election officials who administer elections because of the concerns about the potential or charges regarding election fraud. You had several states, including Georgia, that said, hey, we're going to set up a process involving legislators that are going to now take over some of the responsibilities of the nonpartisan boards. And in Georgia, the election board has been issuing rules, some of them, you know, in the view of election officials, kind of late in the game because people are already going to be starting to vote pretty soon. How do you evaluate the threat of the Georgia election board for a fair counting of votes and a fair access to the ballot box?
I'm sorry, is that directed to me or to Jennifer?
Yes, it is directed to you.
Okay, so, and let me just put in a plug, if this is not enough, I'm going to do another hour on certification at the Safeguarding Democracy Project. We're having a webinar that starts at 12:15 California time, 2:15 Central time. Second of three events today. This is a busy time of the year for those of us in the election field. Here's what I would say about certification. As I mentioned, there's a process after which all the votes are counted by which someone has to say, and these are the votes. And in most states, that is typically happening on the county level and on the state level. It's a ministerial act, which is just a fancy way of saying the person who does that doesn't really have any discretion. They're just basically there to pronounce that these are the votes. And if somebody thinks that there's something unfair, it's not through the certification process that they attack this. It is instead through some kind of judicial action. Or, you know, potentially in a state an administrative complaint, but it's not through the certification process. Certification is generally seen as not something where there's discretion. What these past and proposed rules would do is give local boards the authority to delay certification to conduct what they're calling a reasonable inquiry and potentially like look under the hood and make sure everything looks okay. And because these some of these boards are stacked with people who believe the false claim that the 2020 election was stolen. The concern is that they're going to, at the very least, delay things. We have seen this movie before. We saw it a little bit in 2022 and in some other elections where you've had isolated local election officials who've refused to certify. They refused to do their ministerial job of saying this is the vote count. And the answer to that has typically been for a court to order the boards to do the right thing. The technical term for that is mandamus. That's just a court order to a government official to do your job. And I suspect that if these rules pass, some of them have already passed and some are still being considered, they've been challenged. Some of them have been challenged in state court as violating the legislature's own rules. But assuming that these rules remain in place, I assume that there will be some challenges if there is undue delay. And that, you know, if there's no reason to be delaying things, then they're going to be ordered to certify. And then if there's an election contest, that will go through the normal Georgia process. You may remember in 2020, there was a full hand recount of all the ballots in Georgia that were was cast for president. And the results came in very close to the machine count, which was, you know, I think quite a testament to the Georgia election officials that they were able to do that under time pressure and tremendous political pressure. So, you know, why this certification? Like, what's the end game here? I think there's two things to say. One is, this is another way of trying to delegitimize potential Democratic victories, right? So the Trump forces saying that Trump is still continuing to say the election is stolen, the election is rigged, without any basis in proof that there's any serious problems with how elections are being conducted. And delaying certification will shine a light on what's going on and potentially provide the fodder for delegitimizing Democratic victories or potentially trying to argue for Congress to do something other than accept the Electoral College votes if Trump loses a state like Georgia. The other thing is there's a kind of Hail Mary play here that I think is behind the scenes. And that would be if you could muck things up so much in a state like Georgia, let's say Georgia is the dispositive state on who wins the presidential election. And you could muck things up so much in the state that Georgia does not send in any votes for president. Then what you do is, you know, you create the conditions in Congress where maybe you could, that under the new Electoral Count Reform Act, you take Georgia out of the denominator. It makes it slightly easier for, you know, Trump to maybe win in other states. Depends on the margin. The math gets a little complicated. But the idea is, delay to the point of disenfranchising all the voters of a state. I don't think the courts would stand for it. Millions of voters would have their votes essentially thrown out for president. But that, I think, is the kind of most extreme way that delays in certification could actually affect the outcome.
Thank you. Jennifer, both of us have talked with plenty of people who've got, you know, I think, aw shucks questions about elections. They're not partisans. They're not people supporting a candidate. They just don't know a whole lot about how the process works. And they'll say, come on, there are 155 million ballots that were cast. You can't tell me that, you know, some of those ballots, maybe a large number of them, you know, weren't cast by people who weren't eligible, that ballots weren't changed. Could you walk us through the process by which election officials decide who's eligible to vote, the casting of the ballots, the security of the ballots, and then the checking and the double checking? You know, why do you have confidence that our election process is one with integrity?
Well, Larry, how many hours do you have? First of all, let's just step back a little bit and remember, just listening to Rick reminded me that all of these officials and the folks that work with them all take an oath that they take really seriously, just like I did when I entered the military. They take an oath to uphold and defend the rules and laws of their state, as well as the Constitution of the United States and of their state. And that's important because even when they are working to, you know, share information, do things better, they still have to uphold the laws. So when it comes to certification, even if they're willing to share statistics or reports about on things that aren't required as part of that Canvas process, the rules and laws are, this is the minimum. This is what has to happen as part of Canvas and part of certification. And as Rick said, it's a ministerial process. Okay, how do we trust all of these things? First of all, there's no one individual. Election administration is very much reliant on members of the public, teams, bipartisan teams. Almost every single thing that transpires is often done not by an individual, but done either in teams, bipartisan teams, by groups of staff. When we talk about issuing ballots, reviewing ballots, tabulating ballots, those are, we rely on a lot of temporary workers, poll workers, election judges from the community. So there are lots of eyes and ears. In terms of registration, I would just remind people, majority of individuals that register today are registering in a Department of Motor Vehicles, or they're registering online, where there are checks on eligibility happening before that transaction can even go through. Certainly, we rely tremendously on the attestation on the registration form to eligibility. That is a legal document that they are attesting to. But there are plenty of checks within each state to verify eligibility, to verify both citizenship, as well as just eligibility. Do they live in this precinct, district, community, what have you? And list maintenance, that process of regularly ensuring that the database or the list of voters that we have, that those individuals, that is correct and up to date, that's ongoing. That's happening all the time. It's happening through a combination of things, of information being exchanged between state vital statistics offices, Department of Corrections, national change of address updates that are being shared of states, and certainly those states that still participate in the electronic registration and information sharing center known as ERIC, are regularly reviewing those lists. Wow, so many checks when it comes to issuing and casting ballots. I'll try to be quick. Issuing, counting, casting ballots. I think the one that seems to get the most scrutiny are mail or absentee ballots. So maybe I'll just start there real quick and remind folks that every single ballot that's issued has a unique identifier as well as the voter ID number. And when that comes in, that doesn't go any further. That doesn't get opened, doesn't get pushed on for tabulation until that's verified that that same ballot that came back was the ballot that was issued to that voter. Once that happens, there's a whole series of reviews or verifications. Each state is different in the way that they do that, but there is some sort of validation, again, before that envelope is opened, that is indeed the that voter is the eligible voter who has returned that ballot. It could be signature verification, verification of the last four of their social, verification of a witness, or completion of an affidavit. There is some sort of verification that happens in every state. Once that happens and those ballots are prepared for tabulation, again, that voting equipment's been tested and prepared to only accept ballots that were programmed on that system, right? So we can't just arbitrarily make up our own ballot and try to slide that into the system. The voting technology itself has been designed and tested to detect that. And then when we get to the end of the election, we go back and mail ballot, very similar process for in-person, where when we go and we're issued an in-person ballot, same sets of verifications, something to say, are you who you say you are when you're voting in person? Maybe signing the e-poll book, maybe presenting ID, maybe giving some information. Varies in every state, but there's some sort of verification process. Similarly, voting equipment's been programmed specifically for that election, for that jurisdiction or precinct. And then I'll just quickly kind of fast forward to post-election. We now have all but about five states doing some form of post-election audit to ensure that the voting equipment accurately interpreted each voter marking on ballots and was able to do the math, meaning adding those votes up and allocating them appropriately to the winning and losing candidates. That's happening all across the country, in most cases prior to certification, to again ensure that the system is secure and accurate. So that's tough for me to do in a nutshell. I'll just remind folks, we spend an entire semester talking about election security. So
yeah, thank you so much. And I have to say, I'm amazed. I'm gonna get an excerpt for what you just did, because there are books written about what you've just presented, and it's, you've just distilled it. So folks who have questions about, you know, about the integrity of our election system, I would suggest getting the recording, which we'll send out in a day or two, and going back and just slowly listening to what Jennifer Morrell just laid out. It's a very detailed process and set of procedures that have been developed over a number of decades and revised, always to improve the integrity of the process. And you know, even the post-election audits, with which Jennifer mentioned at the end, relatively new, but it's again another effort by election officials to say, look, you don't think any of that mattered. We're going to now do this check after the election. And by the way, losing candidates often go to court, or do go to court, to challenge the results, and the courts get involved and they'll review some of these steps that Jennifer just laid out. So this is not a casual process. The idea of like ballots somehow showing up overnight, that's not the real world. It's just not the real world. Rick Hassan, I've got a basic question that comes up. Elections in America are mostly conducted in the state and local level. And you often hear folks who don't appreciate the law and the administration of elections thinking somehow Joe Biden could fix the election. Why is that? What is the kind of overall legal structure in America that makes it impossible really for Joe Biden to fix an election?
Well, it's interesting you say this, because one of the defenses that Donald Trump is raising in his election interference case in Washington, D.C., the one that was the subject of the immunity appeal to the Supreme Court that's now back before the district court, is he said, the court gives immunity for official acts. And one of the things he said, well, when I was looking into the problems with the election, that was an official act. And one of the things that the government is saying is the president has no role in the election. And so this is something that's going to be the subject probably of future litigation, at least if Donald Trump doesn't win the next election and gets rid of the prosecution. The Constitution says that states set the manner for conducting presidential elections. It also says that states subject to congressional override set the rules for conducting congressional elections. Right. So the only thing the only role that a president has is in signing or vetoing legislation that Congress might pass that could affect congressional elections. There's no federal agency that runs elections. The closest thing we have came after the disputed 2000 election that ended with the Supreme Court's decision in Bush versus Gore, something called the United States Election Assistance Commission. And typically when I speak to groups and I ask how many people have heard of this organization, this government agency, no hands go up. It's different if I speak to election administrators, but if I speak to just a regular group of students or community members, this agency essentially gives out money, looks at voting machines and you know, says whether they're secure or not, and puts out best practices. That's really this advisory role is and helping to fund state and local elections is really the only thing. Elections, as I mentioned earlier, are decentralized. For the most part, state law delegates the power to actually do the nuts and bolts of elections to counties or sub-county units. And these counties then, the counties may buy their own voting machines subject to state standards. They may have the capacity to decide where voting is going to take place. In California, for example, some states have vote cent some counties have vote centers, as opposed to old precinct style. So it's very decentralized. There's diffusion of power across state and local governments. In some states, secretaries of state, the chief election officer of state, has more power than in other states. But there's no system in which votes go through the White House. So, I'm a long skeptic of the way we run our elections in such a decentralized way. If you look at almost every other democracy in the world, when it's a national election, there's a national nonpartisan body that runs the election. But that's not the model we have in the United States, hasn't been for over 200 years. I don't expect that's going to change in our lifetime. One benefit of that system, as I think is implicit in your question, is that it will be hard for a president to try to intervene in trying to mess with vote totals, which is exactly one of the things we saw in the aftermath of the 2020 election. There weren't a lot of levers that Donald Trump could pull to try to change election outcomes, and at best, he could try to do it indirectly.
Jennifer, another question that often comes up is about efforts to review voter rolls. And so we saw in Nevada recently where inactive filings or inactive files were removed, and it was a large number. Why do election officials and states review and remove files from their voter rolls? And how do we know that that's not part of some nefarious process to deny rights to voters?
Yeah, that's a great question, Larry. I think first, the important thing to keep in mind is when we talk about the voter database, we talk about voter rolls, that's a very dynamic system. It is changing every single day, meaning if you were to look at the data every single day. So when I see these citizen groups that will get like a publicly available file and flag something, I don't even need to look at it to know that it's incorrect, because the file you have today is not going to be the same voter data file a month from now or 6 weeks from now. Meaning every single day, newly registered individuals are being added. People are being removed because there's been a notification that they are deceased, or there's a something we call the confirmation process. It's tied to federal laws that when we get information that indicates a voter may no longer reside at that address or no longer is eligible for certain reasons, we send a formal official notification to them, and we move them from an active status to an inactive status. And there's a lot of implications there that I think most people aren't aware of. And if they haven't voted in two federal elections, they get removed. And often, right, we have to wait for that period of time to pass. And then you might see a large number of people be removed all at once, because that maintenance period, we may wait for a certain month or year to sort of perform that maintenance. So we can see that happening, and it may look like a big spike, but it really is just part of this regular maintenance that's happening.
Great, thank you. Rick, there's, as we've been talking about, there's an elaborate process, legal process, political process after election day. And both you and Jennifer have kind of walked us through the details of that. That process takes time. And one of the concerns about that process, legitimate and important and necessary as it is that it may create a sense of something's up, that, in the months or weeks after election day, something nefarious is going on because the winner has not been declared. There's this period. How do you think about that? I mean, how would you kind of recommend that people prepare themselves for what could be a controversial period after election day, particularly if Donald Trump does not prevail?
So let me remind you that in the 2020 election, We woke up the day after Election Day and did not know who had won the presidency. Part of that was because votes still needed to be counted in a number of states, including Pennsylvania and Arizona, and Georgia. The results were so close, even though Georgia could count faster than Pennsylvania because of their rules about dealing with mail-in ballots. There were a flood of mail-in ballots. On election night, if I recall correctly, Donald Trump in Pennsylvania was ahead by 160,000 ballots. By the time we got to the Saturday after Election Day, Joe Biden had won the state by about 80,000 votes. And of course, that creates, in a polarized environment where you have a candidate claiming elections are being stolen, of course, that creates suspicions. Counting ballots takes time. People who don't want fraud need to recognize that it takes time to process ballots to make sure that only eligible ballots are being counted and that they're being counted accurately. I fully suspect that if the election comes down to Pennsylvania this time, which some people think that could happen, that we, well, again, may not know the results, because Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, unlike most other states, including Republican states like Florida, does not allow for what's called the pre-canvassing or processing of ballots, mail-in ballots, before the morning of Election Day. This is basically checking everything but the ballots themselves to make sure that these ballots are ready to be counted. And there's been legislation to try to do that. Republican legislators have resisted it, maybe because it creates this room for confusion. But it is something that just increases the risks to our elections, and it is irresponsible. And so I'm very upset that these states have not done that. What needs to happen, and we should report a cross-ideological, multidisciplinary group of scholars and lawyers, issued a report last spring called 24 for 24. You can Google it and find the 24 recommendations for free and fair elections, and one of the upcoming election. And one of the things we said is that states should have to pre-process these ballots, that this period in between the time people vote and the time that we know the winner is a very dangerous one in this country. So we need education. There's something that social scientists call the blue shift, which has happened in recent elections. Just to explain that, if more Democrats than Republicans vote by mail, which has been the case in recent elections, especially because Donald Trump had been discouraging voting by mail. If more Democrats than Republicans vote by mail, and if you count more in-person ballots first, it wouldn't be surprising to see leads go from a Republican lead to a Democratic lead in a close election. And so there was a more loaded term, which was red mirage for this phenomenon. I like blue shift, which is Charles Stewart and Ned Foley's term. But the idea, it's a real one. If there's nothing nefarious going on. And so one of the things that we suggested in our report, and we had suggested it in an earlier report as well, one related to 2020, is that the messaging from the media is very important. So rather than saying that candidate X is in the lead, what you have to telegraph is that it is too early to call. So voters understand there is no lead. Like, all the ballots are in. There is a winner. We just don't know who it is yet. We have to wait for the ballots to be counted. And so the most important thing here is public education. Here's the process by which it's working. Election officials need to have transparency by which they explain how these processes work. Observation for those who want to see the processes in action. But it's really a public education problem. It doesn't help when you have a candidate, throwing out wild claims of fraudulent elections. But it is understandable why people would wonder. That's why you hear about the ballot dumps from Detroit. Let's talk about Michigan for 1 second, and then I'll turn it back to Jennifer. But Detroit is a big city compared to small counties that can get their ballots counted more quickly. So let's talk about ballot dumps. Like 2 o'clock in the morning, all of a sudden, a bunch of ballots come in from Detroit. Like, that's not nefarious. That's Detroit's a big city. They're trying to get their counting done. It takes them a while. They're not the most efficient at it. And, they did actually a lot better in 2020 than they had done in the past because they brought in a great election administrator from the state level to supervise everything. Republican was in there who could vouch for everything that was going on. So it's not a ballot dump. It's that we finally got enough ballots counted that we could give you some results. And so I think the public needs to just understand that.
Yeah, I think if I can add a couple of things there, that balance between speed and accuracy is the thing that every election official is always looking very closely at. We talk a lot about the results that are reported on election night are always unofficial, right? Because there are still other ballots that need to be counted up to that canvas or certification deadline if you're in a state that allows for the curing of mail or absentee ballots, our ballots coming in for our, from our military and overseas voters, and provisional ballots that need to be researched and adjudicated. So one important thing I always point out to people is understand when you're looking at those initial unofficial results, what are you looking at? Most jurisdictions have gotten better now at talking about their buckets of ballots, meaning these are how many ballots we've received and processed, and this is what's remaining to be counted or reviewed or dealt with. And so understanding what's still outstanding, I think, is really important. Rick mentioned pre-processing, and he's right. We've got to let these states do pre-processing. And I think I don't know how we've tried again over the last 4 years to educate legislators that again, this is an administrative process. We're not tabulating votes. We're really just taking that return mail ballot through the process of verifying that it was the ballot that was issued, verifying the voter that returned it, the eligibility of that voter, verifying that it is a true and accurate ballot, and getting those prepped and ready. It's a really tedious process to open and extract and flatten and make those ballots ready to be scanned, and that takes days and hours of time or hundreds of people and large amounts of space, which is usually something most jurisdictions don't have. So giving them that pre-processing time would help tremendously. And I agree with Rick. At this point, we've talked about it so much. I start to wonder if those that are reluctant to allow pre-processing are just using that as a way to create some chaos or some challenges at the end.
Jennifer, I've got a few questions here in response to the steps that you were laying out to prevent fraud. One question is if these steps are in place and they're as effective as you say, why are there still instances of fraud that are reported?
So first of all, there are no systemic instances, right? We know that there are individual instances that make headlines or are identified. This is still a human process. We're still talking about human beings, just like you and I, and all of the people we know that are either data entry clerks doing processing or motor vehicle clerks doing intake of individuals. And so mistakes do occasionally happen. Sometimes there is intentional, sometimes it is intentional, but often what we find is when those registrations get through. It is often a human mistake that happened, but there are no, these are in really small numbers, ones and twos in states where millions of voters cast ballots. So I think it's important to understand the context. It's still a human process. There's still lots of opportunity for improvement, but we've gotten so much better. And I think that's the thing I would remind people. We've gotten so much better at sharing information. Technology has allowed us to do that more quickly, more often, in terms of going through and verifying or comparing our voter rolls to other information sources to ensure that the voters we have are in fact eligible voters.
Yeah, and the comment that I often hear is, okay, you say it's one or two or a dozen, but how do you know? How do you know if there are a dozen, maybe there are 500? And just so you're not repeating yourself, your answer would be something along the lines of the tutorial you gave a few minutes ago about all the steps. Is that right?
Yeah, and also nothing gets done quietly anymore, right? We are now a country, a society where everything is out in the open and quickly reported. And when we do see these single instances, they're often well known and identified. So.
Another question on this fraud issue. In Minnesota, immigrants who are not yet citizens can get a driver's license. And the question is, if that's possible, can't they just show up for same-day registration and cast a ballot, even though they're not citizens?
Yeah, and that's the case in many states, right? We want individuals that are here pursuing citizenship through a legal pathway to be licensed and registered and know that they understand the rules and laws of the road. There is a system when they go to register at DMV to flag them as a non-citizen. I've sat behind DMV clerks and watched them go through that process. And again, there are potentially instances where somebody clicks the wrong button, and that's usually caught quickly. Absolutely, are they not submitted that information, that data set, once they are checked as being a non-citizen, that data is not passed on to the Secretary of State or to state election officials for processing as a registered voter.
Can I just add something here that when someone signs up to register to vote, they sign under penalty of perjury that they're a citizen. So imagine you're a non-citizen in the United States. You don't have status, full legal status. You know, maybe you're a permanent resident, but maybe you're not. Maybe you don't have legal status. You're going to risk a felony by signing in and voting. It seems very unlikely. And what I would say is that this has been thoroughly investigated. So Donald Trump claimed in the 2016 election that there were 3 million people who were non-citizens who voted, all for Hillary Clinton, he told ABC's David Muir back in 2016. And there were investigations around the country, and there were only 30, not 300, 3,000, 30,000, 300,000, 3 million, fewer than 30 possible cases that were investigated. I would point people to chapter one of my book, Election Meltdown, which talks about a trial that took place in Kansas before a Republican judge, where Kris Kobach claimed that the amount of non-citizen voting he found was the tip of the iceberg, and the judge decided there was no iceberg, there was an icicle made up principally of administrative error. The same reason some people were listed as being born in the 1870s. It is not a major problem in this country.
And just to add to that, if I'm a non-citizen, do I really want to fill out a form and give the government my name, my address, my date of birth, my signature, my phone number, and my email address potentially?
Rick, you had mentioned earlier your 24 for 24 report and the recommendations, and I recommend it. And that you had been encouraging kind of shortening of the period between the election day and then the counting of the ballots. One of the questions is, why not just make it law that no announcements can be made by election offices about results until all the ballots have been counted?
Well, besides the fact that there might be a First Amendment issue with that, that itself would create all kinds of conspiracy theories. What are they hiding? I hear rumors that the numbers are X, and then it comes out the numbers are Y. So I think transparency is the key. What I thought you were going to say is, why can't everybody get it all counted within 2 days? And I'd say, like, give a few more $1 billion to election officials, and we can make it happen, right? But there's just not enough money, and there are trade-offs. But there are things that can happen, most importantly, pre-processing of mail-in ballots. That is the number one step that should be taken. But even so, in California, because we have so many ballots, we may not know control of Congress for weeks because it just takes a very long time to count so many ballots that come in by mail in a large state like California.
I want to thank everybody for the terrific questions and conclude very quickly because we're almost out of time with a question from Nancy Christensen, which is, what resources would you recommend that folks download or purchase? Jennifer?
Oh, gosh, there's so many from so many good organizations. Certainly would love to have you go to our website, theelectionsgroup.com. Most of our stuff is geared towards election administrators, but there are some communication one-pagers that may be helpful as you're trying to explain some of these things. So many good nonprofit organizations now. States United Democracy is another one that's put out some good explainers. Let's compile a list, Larry, that you can send out after this to your viewers.
The National Conference of State Legislatures has a great website that very nonpartisan, you know, just how many days do you have before registration closes? Those kind of things. You can find a lot of those statistics there.
Yeah, we partner with them and they are terrific. Great. Well, this has been terrific. And I think folks who tuned in have really been rewarded with a fantastic conversation. Jennifer Morrell, Rick Hassan, thank you so much. If you give me 1 minute, I just want to mention some upcoming events. Very excited. September 17th, that's next week. The Certificate in Election Administration, which is the program that Jennifer teaches in, the largest online training program. If you want to get involved and become an election official, one of our star faculty, Judd Choate, we'll be speaking with Ryan Drysdale from All In. It's a nonpartisan effort to support 1,000 colleges and universities to increase civic engagement, and it coincides with National Voter Registration Day. Totally nonpartisan, and that's going to be terrific. September 17th, you can see it here. Second, we have started a series called Conservative Voices, which I moderate with a former Republican member of Congress, Vin Weber. We've got the president of the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Doerr, coming in to talk about the conservative agenda for addressing poverty. That's going to be terrific. Robert Doerr is a major figure. And these are all will be at noon Central Time. And you see the links here. October 2nd, my collaborator and good friend, Chloe Thurston from Northwestern, will be moderating a panel that's going to be looking at the decline in support among Blacks and Latinos for the Democratic Party and asking whether this is part of a conservative shift towards the Republican Party as part of the sorting process that we've seen more generally. October 9th, we've got two of our favorites coming back. Kirsten Kukowski, who is a Republican consultant, and Rebecca Piercy, who is a Democratic consultant, was the manager for Elizabeth Warren's presidential campaign. They're going to come in, talk about where things stand in terms of presidential election, congressional elections. Very smart. They take you behind the scenes, and they're lovely people. So it's done with intelligence and humor, which we need a lot of. Okay, we're out of time. Just want to quickly mention video recording is available. We'll have it out to you. If you've registered, you'll get a link in a day or two. And also, if you've enjoyed this program, we would be grateful for a contribution to help support what we're doing. Once again, thank you so much, Jennifer Morrell, Rick Hassan. This has been a terrific conversation. Appreciate it. Take care, everybody.